Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Garden. If you're going to plan a wildlife garden, you need to do the planning. You want to look for some specific things maybe on your existing property, such as, you know, what vegetation overlay do I have? Do I have trees, shrubs? Do I have plants that I don't want to see wildlife in? Or it could make some issues for me down the road if there's something that you prune. Very often, you probably don't want birds nesting in that rose bush or whatever you move. Having water, having hedgerows. So you really need to look at your property, look at what you have. And then the other big thing is to consult either the Audubon Society or someone that deals with wildlife in your county or in your city to find out what is in that area. And also what plants are being utilized by the wildlife in the area.
Mostly gophers.
Well, the gophers aren't bad, actually.
Says you.
Hey, I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Where they are.
So, I know this is kind of obvious, but if you want to have wildlife in your garden, you have to provide some things. Well, there has to be a food source. And when I say food, I'm more of the provide natural food. A lot of my friends who are Audubon folks, they feed birds and they have multiple feeders, whether it be seed, suet, whether it be a hummingbird feeder. I don't necessarily agree with that where I'm at, so I don't have any bird feeders. What I try to do is provide vegetation or plants that provide the food. I'm not saying that those things are... those things should not be considered, but they shouldn't be considered lightly. You really need to think ahead, and I'll show you why in a moment. Water. Water can be in the form of a garbage can lid, a shallow basin filled up for birds, for some reptiles, amphibians. Most amphibians we have here are frogs and toads, if not all. Very, very, very few salamanders. There are salamanders, like the wild salamander from the south, but not many. Create cover. We'll talk about that. Place to raise young, and then maintaining a healthy, sustainable habitat. And we'll talk about that in a moment. So, these are some ways you can provide food. Once again, the bird feeder, and then the milkweed with the fritillary butterfly. So, you know, you could plant milkweed. We do for monarch, but there's lots of other butterflies and skippers that use those plants. And then I threw up blackberries. But I know, John, I thought about maybe some raspberries or boysenberry or something like that, but I know how much you love blackberries, so I threw that up there just for you. Yeah. And so we'll get some blackberries from Jack if anyone wants. He has lots. But these are all good food sources for wildlife. There's lots of others that can be considered. But in putting up the artificial feeders, these are the things you run into. This happens all over. When my mom was living in Colorado, she called me one night and she said, "Patrick, there's a bear at my bird feeder." And I said, "Mom, we've talked about that. You need to do something." So she corrected it for bears, and then she called me a month later and said, "There's elk at the bird feeder." And I'm like, So finally, when I went out to see her, I just got rid of them and said, "Mom, you got enough natural food sources around. You don't need to be feeding them." Her other issue was squirrels. And then raccoons. These can all be positively dealt with without having to capture the animal, without having to haze the animal. But you can see in many of the cases, having it next to a tree, having any type of pole that a critter can climb, and having it low to the ground is not such a good idea. Now, from a bird standpoint, what they're finding out is that a lot of the year-round feeders are tracking birds, and it is delaying the migration of certain birds, or they're seeing populations of birds increase because they're not moving south. So in other words, if they can move into an area where there's feed year-round, then that drive to migrate is lessened somewhat. So it goes back and forth. Hummingbird feeders, you know, same type of thing. If you feed hummingbirds during the winter, and I have friends where I've been to their home, and if you go out on their deck, you're you know, ducking and weaving because there are so many. This one home that I went to, there was over 100 hummingbirds on 10 feeders, you know, on this deck, and it was just incredible. Mostly Anna's hummingbirds, there were some calliope and some other black hen. But got to think about those things, plus you got to maintain them. So let's say you want to go overseas for 2 months. Well, what happens when you're gone for the 2 months? The hummingbirds have to go somewhere else. Or we don't want to clean those things. I mean, when you start seeing fungus and mold and things growing in the hummingbird feeders, or even grain feeders or seed feeders, it's not a good idea. Because those things will be passed on to the birds. Water is extremely critical. And there's all different types of sources or different types of structures or basically watering holes. Now, this is a quail guzzler that I put in on my property. And what's really interesting is you see 3 turkey vultures there now. I've had as many as 10. And what I've noticed over the last 3 years is that when it's hot like this, you see them hovering around in the morning, and then you go, where did they go? And that's why I put cameras out there. They will travel some distance just to get to this water source. And during the drought, this is what they primarily used in the area that I live. So it's something that I have to think about because I'm not only watering cattle, which is also used, the cattle use this as well, but also lots of other critters. The cattle prefer it because it's low to the ground and they're always getting fresh water. It's different from a trough. So there's always water cycling through this. It's just an option that is out there for providing water. This is another one, and we talked to a gentleman, Chase and I, at the garden tour, because he was wondering about, you know, ground level water structures. What I found over the years, and that's why you'll notice the area around it is clear. When I was dealing with ducks on ponds in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and we had, I'll call it an invasion, they're natives, but bulrush and cattails, what we noticed was they became so tall and so thick that when ducks were coming in, ducks like to look at the water and where they're landing. So these became so tall, we saw our duck population drop way off. We went in and we burned them and we cleared some areas and we opened them up and the ducks came back. On this particular one, I have creeping wild rye around this area. It usually gets about 2 to 3 feet tall. I keep it down now because what I found out was shortly after this photograph, I started to see fewer birds coming to the watering source, this little pool. And once I cut it down, they came back. Because a lot of these lark sparrows, there's a red-shafted flicker and a junco in here. I've had as many as 10 different species of birds in this. And this pool is, it's 5 feet long and about 3 feet wide. And the way I constructed it, the far end slopes down. So you're gaining about, I think it's an inch over 3 or 4 inches. And then where the flicker is, it's deeper. Because what I also found out was, like lark sparrows, they love to bathe, but they don't like deep water. So what they'll do is they'll come in from the edges just like they are, and they'll bathe in that area. But they won't go over where the flicker is. So that's kind of like when you're planning water structures, things to think about, knowing the natural history of the birds. In this particular case, I've had turkey vultures, red-shouldered hawks, deer, coyote, bobcat using this quite often. And they don't mind kind of congregating together. These are interesting in that these are goldfinches. You'll notice there's one on the second tier and then at the very top. They like getting that really vigorous stream of bubbling water at the top. They prefer that. They will not go to that basin water that I have. And they're separated by, 30 feet or so. So it's really interesting how this bird loves that. Now, maybe forced to, they would. But they also, I've had as many as 15 goldfinches on that top, and they're just crowded in there. Hummingbirds, the same thing. Hummingbirds will actually come into that bubbling top and fly through it, or rest, or basically hover and drink. But they prefer that. I've seen them using the other one on really, really super hot days, and if this isn't running. But, and then 2 weeks ago, I had a red-shouldered hawk in the bottom basin, baiting. So it's pretty crazy. But these are just some, you know, some things you might provide for water. Problem is, if I go away for 2 or 3 months and I can't run that, and if I can't fill the other basin, then I have to think about, okay, where are those animals going? The guzzler I have is self-feeding, it's on a float, and as long as the 1,700-gallon tank is full of water, we're fine. This one is a little bit more difficult because it has a pump in it. The other one, I just take a drip line, and some of you have seen the drippers they have for fountains, where it's just a constant small amount. That's what I put in there if we're going to be gone for a while, because it does dry up pretty quickly. The contamination issue over a long period, I can't deal with because I'm gone, but normally I can deal with it. And that's the other thing Audubon came out with a couple of years ago. Their recommendation is that you change the water in all your structures at least once a week.
Yes. Considering they poop in it every day, pretty much have to clean it every day. I mean, that's the big contamination is they come in with that poop in it too.
That's true, but I have to say, and it's only because I'm cleaning these things, my biggest issue is algae buildup. And I know this is going to sound weird, but I have goldfish in the lower basin. And the goldfish actually keep it very clean, and I put in a rock for shelter, nobody bothers them. But then you think, well, you know, the goldfish or the fish poop. It's great because this one I clean out, so when I water my plants, I can take the water from there with all this nice fish fertilizer in there, and it works out really well. But it, all of these things require some maintenance. It's not like you can throw it out there and it's fine. And believe me, I've gone out to looked at some of these where you just tell people, shut it off, clean it out, because you're going to kill something because it's that bad. But so Audubon's recommending at least once a week.
Everything, even the hummingbird feeders?
Probably more often, depending on how quickly they're bringing the level down, especially in the heat. And
every day.
Yeah, every day is probably a good idea. And the thing is, it's parasites, either from the droppings, as Jack was saying, but all those little parasites, bacterium and so forth that they can bring in, they can get dispersed through a bird population. So that's why you want to make sure these things are cleaned up. So cover. And this is an interesting one because we're dealing with fire right now. And so everybody's thinking about, we want to remove brush and everything around structures, make it as defensible as possible. But what if I have a woodland like this where it's, say it's an annual grassland with some oaks, or it's an oak savanna, but I want to provide some cover for quail, for dove, even for small creatures that are running around through the grassland. This is an area that gets fenced, it doesn't get grazed, except for maybe about 2 or 3 weeks out of the year prior to the summer. So the grasses are somewhat tall. I found out here that I can get a really nice quail population and then California towhees and spotted towhees because of leaving a little bit more grass and then also providing the brush pile. These, you have to, one thing, they don't last forever. A big thing around here is they burn up. So you may have to, you know, replenish them. And then you really do have to be very careful. You notice this is out in somewhat of an opening. So, you know, you kind of predict, well, fire hits it and starts, I'll torch the foliage on the oak trees will probably be scorched or torched, but at least the trees will survive. I'll show you some other photos of different types of brush shelters you can provide. And some of these, you know, once again, it depends. The one in the top I really like, this is one that's used up in Washington State with all the mix of evergreens and hardwoods. And it provides perching areas, it provides good access for ground mice and wood rats and so forth to get up into the upper story of the brush pile. And it also provides an area around the basin you can see there's a little rabbit underneath there. But the problem is, you know, can you cut the trees down, and then what type of fire hazard does that potentially create? The one with the rock piles works well, and I threw in the hedgerow because gardens, you can have a beautiful hedgerow that can provide lots of cover and habitat for birds. And it's more of that formal appearance. It just doesn't have to be rough in structure. Believe it or not, there are there's a number of universities across the country that actually have a set of plans for creating a brush pile. You might say, well, how hard can it be? It's not simply just putting sticks on the ground. It's creating, like you have done here, placing some rocks or logs so that you keep, well, and depending on what wildlife you want to bring in, sometimes these brush piles will be used by gray fox, red fox, rabbits. Sometimes, pardon?
Snakes
too.
Oh.
So basically, there is a design, there is a level of design planning associated with that. Snags. Now, how many people have any snags on their property? I know Jack probably has a lot. Okay. Do you manage your snags?
I'm trying to.
And I'm just being, so when I say manage, do you look at how many snags you have per acre?
Yeah.
What kind of snags? What the height is?
6 to 8 per acre.
So Jack's 6 to 8 acres. It can depend on, this is a foothill pine with some blue oak. So if you're in a dense conifer stand with very few hardwoods, it may be a chance. But that's a good rule of thumb, 6 to 7 an acre. What you also have to look at is replacement value, and I'll tell you why. So this is this was a foothill pine that died. My well house is just to the left, about 30 feet. So when PG&E came out, they said, we're gonna take the whole thing down to the ground. And I said, no, I wanna high stump it. High stumping is when you start off at 20, 30, or 40 feet, and basically you cut it off there. What I did was, even though you can see it's leaning, and it's leaning right at my pump house. So we measured the lean, we looked at some of the heavier branches, and we looked at the longevity of it, and we said, yeah, we can do it, and I convinced them to do this. Now, what they did was they just cut the heck out of it and left everything for me to deal with. So I was able to actually create some additional habitat with it. And you can see I have my little friend over here. I gotta use something that, new technology. So right next to that little light is an acorn woodpecker. And that was my primary focus, was to provide habitat for them. There's other cavity nesters, tree swallows, bluebirds, but this is what I provided. 3.5 years after this fell. In fact, it fell this winter. And actually, it fell about 10 feet from the well house, no problem. But the really sad thing was, it was occupied at the time, and it killed 2 acorn woodpeckers, unfortunately.
Aww.
But they had used it for some time, monitored it over the years. But it's okay to have snags, but it's back to planting. Where are you going to have them? And this one lasted, so after it died and it went to the ground, it was probably about 6 years total. So if I'm looking at 6 to 7 snags per acre, you have to look at, okay, what's the longevity of a grape pine? So if one starts to decline, rather than take it out, maybe you go, okay, that'll be the follow-up snag in that acre. It's all up to what you want to do, but just some things to think about. I'll tell you, I've talked to some folks about being creative with snags and creating snags. They'll actually take live trees and they'll cut the tops, but what they do is they create a jaggedness. So in other words, with chainsaws, you can go in there and make it look like it's snapped off. And it doesn't look like a, like mine did, where they just cut it flat off, and you can see that it's been high stumped. Bird boxes, and what you can, you know, the thing about bird boxes is, a lot of it is based upon the opening within the box, as you can see here. Now, this was originally put up, or they were put up as bluebird boxes, not because I don't have cavities, because they're everywhere, but I wanted to put bluebird boxes up there for my granddaughter so she and I could monitor these over time. Well, what occupied them was tree swallows, which is okay. But what you find out from bird natural history is that Bluebirds don't like to be close to one another. When you space bluebird boxes out 100, 150 feet,
at least.
Tree swallows, they don't care. The other thing is, tree swallows are very accommodating of bluebirds. After this one, you can't see it, but I put in another box that's about 12 feet away from this one, and the bluebirds went into that one. So, you know, they're fine. Constructing it, you got to think of, I have cattle, so you'll notice I have a PVC pipe over the T-post, because I learned that any T-post on my property, the cattle will push over. So when they push on the pipe, it's not a really nice surface. You can see where they were trying
to get a scratch.
Right, exactly. So they pushed right through and didn't knock it over. Height can make a difference, facing, you know, what direction. And the other thing I put these boxes in here for is bluebirds love grasshoppers. And I was having a tremendous problem with grasshoppers eating my oaks in those cages. So I put the boxes up there, and it's hard to monitor, but what I did notice, and who knows if it is, you know, if it's based upon the tree swallows and the bluebirds, but the number of grasshoppers on those oaks was almost nothing this year. But as you can see, they sit there, they come out of the box. These are the two adult birds. They come out of the box and they'll sit. And I've actually watched them drop down and get grasshoppers. So it's just another thought. You know, I went to a farm in Missouri, where they had put up swallow boxes all throughout their pastures. And I was talking to them about fly control, because that is an issue. You know, either you have a baited bag, or you have a bag filled with a pesticide, or you spray the animals. They put up swallow boxes, and the fly problem just dropped dramatically. And in fact, to the point where they used nothing, and their cattle were, there were still flies, but the flies were dropped way down. And so, you know, the idea of using, whether it's owls in your vineyards to control mice and voles, or even in this case, using birds to help kind of manage some of your insect issues. So getting to the crawly creatures around you, and I know everybody loves snakes. Everybody loves snakes. But all of these were right around my home, and that's why I thought I could throw them in there, because we're talking about wildlife in the garden around your home. This is not out on the property. So the common king snake, I see them quite often. The western toad, I know it's hard to see, but they're nicely camouflaged. And then western fence lizards, and these are all real common. I also have rattlesnakes right around my house, which we manage. We have gopher snakes, we have garter snakes, we have skinks, we have alligator lizards. So we have a whole array of creatures, those small. We have no cats. Cats, and I'm not going to go into cats. Because think of the millions of birds that cats take every year.
They also eat gophers.
So, western toads, where do they like to live most of the year? Gopher burrows. So remember I mentioned gophers are good? Gopher burrows. Around my house, certain times of the year, I can go around and look down in the holes and I see a toad poking its head out, or I can just see its eyes. How about tree frogs or chorus frogs this time of the year? Gopher burrows. Red-legged frogs. Gopher burrows or squirrel burrows. King snakes, gopher burrows. Western fence lizards throughout the rocks, but also gopher burrows. When I moved into my property, I started, because I had periwinkle problems and all these invasives, so I tried to do what I could, but then I started using herbicides. But once I started seeing these creatures around, I said, no more spraying, so it's a no-spray zone. But all I can say is we have a lot of gophers, and I've lost a lot of plants. I've lost a lot of cacti from the gophers, too. But it's one of those things where I just tolerate, because they provide incredible habitat for these creatures here. And they would not, at least the toad and the frogs would not survive the summer if it wasn't for those. So the Demonstration Garden is a National Wildlife Federation certified wildlife garden. How many people knew that? Yeah. Excellent. Everybody knows. So when I first saw that at the demonstration ground, I'm like, okay, this is excellent, but what are we providing there? So visualize the demonstration garden, because maybe what you can do is think of that and apply it to your home if you want to bring wildlife in. So think about food. Do we provide that at the demonstration garden?
Yes.
Right, vegetables, we have fruit trees, we have John's berries, we have all these great things for birds. I don't know, I think I'm up to like 12 different species of birds that I've seen in the garden, and that's just in passing through. But it's really cool, it's bringing a lot of birds in. Do we provide water? No. And I'm not knocking the demonstration garden, but I'd also want to bring it up that it's a part of the certification and a part of having a wildlife garden is to provide water. We do have a bird bath there, but it's not really, there's no water. Could we? Possibly. But do we want to introduce that to the garden? That's a decision that, you know, we all
lots
will have
cats.
To discuss. Pardon?
Lots of cats.
Lots of cats.
Yeah, we have cats.
And that's why when you put in a bird bath, especially the one that's there, if there's birds in there, those cats are going to get those birds very easily. So it's a matter of designing something that works. But we could probably provide that if we all agreed that it was a good thing. But this is the planning phase. We go, okay, if we bring more animals in, are we going to lose more fruit, lose more berries? Are we going to have more cats because the cats are coming in for more birds? So it's you know, that decision-making process that we need to go through. Cover? We have pretty good cover in there. What I've noticed is the oak trees, the walnut, and even the elm that's dropping thousands and thousands of leaves year-round, it's a pain. It's still providing cover for a lot of creatures. And then as far as places for young, I haven't found any nests, but in the native garden area, I'm sure there are ground-dwelling animals that are using that to raise their young. We have fence lizards in the garden, but as we saw at one of the open gardens, we were all watching as a cat scurried in and grabbed it and then went off. So, you know, it's one of those things. But back to planning, is there anything we can do? We've talked about trapping the cats out there. We've talked about dealing with the neighbors, you know, trying to do something, but we really can't control it. So it's something that we have to put into the mix when we're designing or when we're considering whether that is truly a wildlife garden and whether we're going to have wildlife there. And the last thing I want to bring up is the whole idea of sustainability. That's where you go through all the planning and you develop this wildlife garden, but then you move away. Or you develop this wildlife garden and you can't maintain it. Or you develop something that, whoops, I didn't plan, and in 15 years this shrub is going to die. Or this shrub is going to lose the structure that I love right now and I have to replace it. So I know it's a lot of thinking into the future, but if you're going to bring in plants, if you're going to provide a water source, can that be sustained into the future? Can those plants be sustained? If you're going to put up bird boxes, it's not, once again, slap them up and never go clean the nest out. Never go clean it out. You know, these bluebird trails, you'll see owners of those and the Audubon folks at Monitor, they go out after nesting season and everything gets pulled out and those nest boxes get cleaned. And that's what you need to do with all nest boxes. Now you might say, well, if they're in a cavity, they're not cleaning out the nest box. Well, there's the artificial boxes, and believe it or not, with all those organisms that are in the tree, you know, you think about all those small little insects that are kind of scurrying about in the nest. Well, there's insects that are actually, you know, utilizing those. That's their prey. That's what they're using as a food source. Whereas a artificial box, there's nothing in there. It's just wood or some other type of material. So something to consider. And when you're planning, you should throw in this whole idea of sustaining it into the future. And one book I want to point out is this one here. Has anyone ever seen this, read this? Do they have it in there? Okay. So it's put out by UC Press. To get a kind of an overview of creating a wildlife garden and some really good suggestions, this is a book that I think think you would really enjoy. And that's all I have. Any questions?